Wonderful to have you here tonight. I know there are a few folks who are here for the first time tonight. Great to have you here. So this is the final night of our course on leadership development for the church, and we're going to talk about church finances. So in particular, I want to talk about three things. One is about stewardship. The second has to do with church finances and some of the definitions that you find, especially on the parochial report, just to kind of get you oriented. And that will get us into some conversations about the strange world of church finances. And then the even stranger and more mysterious world of clergy compensation. Most of you probably won't need to know all the details, but it is helpful for the lay leadership to know that the priest is not trying to hoodwink you and cheat you out of things when he or she is asking for housing allowance and talking about different tax rules and so on. It gets complicated. You'll forget it after tonight, but at least you'll have a handout that you can return to when somebody asks you a question about it, saying, no, I think this is above board, but let me double check, and I'll try to remind myself of how this works. So the first thing I want to talk about is stewardship, and I am going to use these handouts. The stewardship handout isn't as critical to have handy, but when we get into the definitions, I will work off the handouts quite a bit. I believe that we need to start talking about stewardship. To start this conversation by talking about stewardship because, and for those of you who have been with us for the previous 5 weeks, you know that this is an old refrain. What we do in leadership of the church has everything to do with the mission of the church. So it's not just a matter of knowing and understanding the account or being able to balance a budget, but being able to balance a budget in good stewardship. So here's a question for you. Hopefully some of you have some good ideas of answers for you. What is stewardship? Taking care of God's gifts. How else might we describe stewardship?
Responsible use of resources.
Responsible use of resources. So, like, what kind of resources?
Time, talent, treasure. Time, talent, giving back what you've been given.
Giving back from what you've been given. Stewardship has to do with money. It also has to do with what else?
Property.
What else?
Time.
Talent. Anything else? From the perspective of leaders in the church, it has to do with people, relationships, ministries, energy, the environment as well. We are good stewards of our environment. Whether we are good ones or not is another question, right? Stewardship is a way of living that acknowledges that all that we have comes from God, and that all that we have really belongs to God and not to us. We have this sense of, well, this is mine and I get to control it because it's mine, right? And I have a right to that. But stewardship recognizes ownership in a different way. The theology of stewardship recognizes that what we have really belongs to God. We have it in order to tend it for God and for God's purposes. That's true both as individuals and as a community. As a parish church. So stewardship is lived out in lots of different ways. It has to do with what we give. It also has to do with what we save. It has to do with how we spend. It has to do with not just money, but our physical health, the environment, our relationships, our responsibilities at home, in the community, at work. All of this has to do with stewardship. I'm very zealous about stewardship, so I have a very big picture of stewardship. So if the only time that the church talks about stewardship is when the church is asking people to make a pledge to the church, then it really sort of takes that word stewardship and strips it of so much of its meaning, because then it's only about giving money to the church, whereas stewardship really is about much, much more. So one of the things that people talk about is proportional giving. And sometimes you will hear people talk about how, well, you know, God has given you so much, doesn't it just seem right to give God back 10% and you get to keep 90? And I would ask, how much does God want? 100%. Now somebody, I said that to a priest once a long time ago. He said, yes, but people are just getting used to 10%. So one step at a time. And I agree with you there. But yes, God wants 100%. So what we do with what we save, what we do with how we spend it, is all a part of stewardship as well. So teaching this to people is a really important role of leadership in the church. So there are two roles that the parish leadership plays when it comes to stewardship. First, do I have this back here? I do. Look at that. Okay. The big reveal. So there are two roles that leaders have in the parish when it comes to stewardship. One is to be the stewards of parish resources. I think in my handout I put stewards of the parish funds, but that's a little bit too narrow. Certainly you are stewards of the property, the building, but you're also stewards of the time and talents of your parishioners. So it's really possible to take that one person who's doing everything already and get them to do one more thing, but that might be poor stewardship of this person's time and this person's gifts, and you may be asking for a whole lot of burnout for somebody who is otherwise a valuable leader and contributor in the parish. So you may think in terms of stewardship that way. Being a good steward of the parish's resources, then, also should change the way we think about the money and the budget. Sometimes you find a trend in parish leadership when they think about the money that really wants to be protective, especially if things feel tight, if the money feels tight, or if it feels like a matter of survival. Then it seems sometimes that the vestry is there to protect the finances of the church so that no one spends them. I would say that if we think of ourselves as stewards of the parish's finances, then the question is not, the mission is not to protect the funds from being spent, but the question is, how should we spend them the way God would want us to spend them? How should we save them the way God would want us to save them? How do we use them in this way? Because there are churches that close with millions of dollars in the bank. That seems kind of goofy. There's one church I know that looked at their demographics and looked at their shrinking size and said, you know, it would be really crazy for us to close with money in the bank. Let's spend this on trying to rejuvenate the ministry of the church. And that took a certain amount of risk because they were a small congregation. But taking that risk was part of being a good steward. So you remember the parable of the talents? So one person is given one talent and one person is given five talents and the other person is given 10. And the master goes away and the master comes back and says to the person with 10 talents, so what'd you do? And what does he respond with? Made 10 more. Well done, good and faithful servant. And the person who had 5 talents says, I've made 5 more. Well done, good and faithful servant. And the one with 1 talent? Buried in the ground. Protected that talent. Boy, nobody was going to take that talent and use that talent, right? Was it so good for that one? No, that steward was in hot water with the master. In many ways, that's sort of the crux of the parable, right? So how are we, as members of the vestry, good stewards of the parish resources? Time, talent, treasure, the whole nine yards. So that's the first role for leaders in the church. The second role is to lead and teach personal stewardship by word and example, to call people to the Christian discipline of stewardship. So that doesn't just mean giving to the church and pledging to the church or tithing to the church, but it also means a call to a life of prayer. It means engaging in Christian formation and spiritual growth and participating regularly in the ministry of the church, as well as giving generously outside of your own interests or your own family's interests. Not just money and not just for the church. So this is being an example, not only being able to talk about it, but being an example in your own life. So I would encourage you all, those of you who are on vestry, to think about having this as a norm or an expectation for being part of vestry. How many of you have the expectation that you should be pledging to the parish if you're going to sit on the vestry? It's usually pretty much an expectation, because really it's an expectation of church membership. So if you're going to lead the members of the church, then that should be part of the expectation for you. So another thing I would say would be that call people to stewardship all year round, not just for pledging, and not just about money. So you can talk about environmental stewardship. You can talk about stewardship of time. You can talk about stewardship in holistic ways, and you can talk about it in other contexts other than Sunday morning worship. You can study the parables that have to do with stewardship and so on. So this way, people don't just see stewardship as an equivalent to pledging. And part of that, too, is the sense of what it means to raise funds for the church. Sometimes churches, parishes will run a deficit, and they will say, I know what we ought to do. We should have a bake sale, or we should have an auction, or we should have a flea market or something like that. And they try to cover a $20,000 deficit with a bake sale. It isn't going to happen. The other thing that happens is some churches get into this and they say, this is a lot of fun, and we know how to do this, right? Because we do this in our business world, and we talk about cutting a profit, and so what are our costs, and what are we charging people? And it's great, and it's exciting, and people get involved. What happens is parishes can get into this rhythm where really the mission of the church as it's lived out is we're a fundraising machine. See what I mean? So we draw people in and say, oh, you should be involved in this fundraising project. As opposed to, oh, you should be involved in this ministry of the church. What if we put as much energy into prayer as we did into fundraising? That's the contrast that I'm trying to show you. It's okay to do some fundraisers, yes, but be careful, because fundraisers can sort of have a life of their own. Money is something that we as Americans understand and go after. The other thing is it starts to make it feel as if pledging and giving to the church is kind of a fee for services. Well, you know, if I belong to the club down the road, everybody has to pay their dues, so you have to pay your dues, you know, here at this club. Well, if it's fee for services, the club down the road does a better job of the services sometimes. And it's not about fee for services. It's not about the sense of, well, I'll contribute if I like the programs for me this year, or if I'm involved. If it comes out of stewardship, it comes out of one's relationship with God and one's ability to trust God. So this is true with pledging. It's true with tithing as well. And I don't know how often, how many of you talk about tithing in your parishes? So maybe fewer than have expectation for vestry members as pledgers. Tithing can sound really scary to folks who already kind of have their budget set and it feels already tight. But it is something that one can move into. And I have to say, from my own experience and from the experience of many others, it's really life-changing. When you trust God that much, and then you see what God does with what you've trusted God with, you want to trust God with even more. And that's where stewardship is so powerful. It's the stuff of conversion. It's the stuff of changing hearts and minds. There was a fellow that was part of St. Mark's who said, well, I guess there's nothing to do it but just to dive in. And so he and his wife set up a pledge that they were going to tithe that year. And several months later came back and said, this is not working. You know, we're working on our budget to try to sort of balance this and that and the other, and I just don't think we're going to be able to give that. I said, that's fine. That's fine. We're the church. We're not going to send a collection agent after you. In fact, what you're telling me is really where the power of this pledging thing is, and that is it's causing you to look at the other 90% and how you manage your resources and ask God into the other 90% and not just the 10% that you give away. It's that kind of opportunity to really have a more full and complete devotion in our lives that's really the opportunity for stewardship. The church does well financially, you know, if people are practicing good stewardship as well. But think about it that way. Think about it as a Christian discipline, as a spiritual discipline, and the opportunity that people have to really see what God can do and to really be able to trust God with more of who they are. There's a saying, and I think it's slightly different in the original, but I think it was Martin Luther who said, there's first the conversion of the head, and then the conversion of the heart, and last of all, the conversion of the purse. You know, but it seems to be where the rubber hits the road for us. And if we can trust God with that, well, then maybe we can trust God with more of the rest of our lives as well. So if you look at the back of the handout, there are three parts of giving. There's annual giving, capital giving, and planned giving. This is a 50,000-foot flyby of these three things. The annual giving is, of course, the annual pledge, the annual stewardship. Regular giving by members of the congregation. Capital giving are for capital campaigns for special projects, building projects usually, and planned giving would be planning in your will to leave some money for the church. So the annual giving, again, I would say teach and talk about stewardship all year round. I used to be involved in and at one time chaired the Diocesan Stewardship Commission, and we had workshops that we put on in the deaneries to talk about stewardship. And there are a lot of canned programs. There's Consecration Sunday. I don't know how many of you have used Consecration Sunday. There are a few other canned programs out there that do an excellent job. One piece of advice I've heard from a few people is don't do the same thing 2 years in a row. Change it up, your program. But what we ended up doing in these workshops is we talked about the things that were consistent between all these really good and well-run programs. First thing is Bible study. There's a lot in the Bible about money, a lot in the Bible about stewardship. And it has to do with our relationship with God and with each other. So Bible study is one piece. Personal testimony is another one. And when I say personal testimony about stewardship, what I don't mean is somebody who gets up and says, St. Swithin's is a really great place, and we want it to go on, and it's important to shovel the walks and so on, and we have to pay somebody to do that, so I think you ought to give money to St. Swithin's. That's not what I'm talking about. Because, again, that's kind of a club version. It's sort of a fee-for-services kind of mentality. And it's also about, I think this is a good idea. The kind of personal testimony I'm talking about is, well, here's a story that I heard one person talk about. He was, he basically said, you know, there was a time where I was really underemployed. I was finding it hard to keep steady work. And what I would do is I would sort of see what was left over at the end of the month and then give that to church. But I never had anything left over. And then he said, I started giving something to church at the beginning of the month. And strangely enough, at the end of the month, I had money left over. So he would talk about how he trusted God with his finances and what God was able to do with that. Now, he wasn't saying this is an investment strategy. I can earn you 10%, you know, return if you give this much money to the church. It's not like that, right? Because then that's about self-interest and not about giving away. But what his story told, and there I've heard lots of them like it, and I have one I'll share with you that's my own. When we trust God, when we really do believe that God has called us to be generous in some way, God will make it possible. God will make it possible. So there was a time I was single at the time, and I was trying to, you know, stretch in my giving, and I think I was already giving 10%, but I felt called to give a little bit more. So I increased the amount that I had set aside to give to church and other charitable organizations. And a couple of weeks later, I got a raise. And I wasn't expecting the raise. I didn't know anything was due for a raise. And then when I did the math, working backwards, the amount in dollars that I had set aside was the same percentage that I used to give. I thought, that's not a bad deal, really.
Bob, you should clarify. You, at that time, you weren't working for the church, correct?
Correct. I was a layperson. Yes. Yes, I was a layperson at the time. When I got married, my wife and I had to talk about this whole tithing thing, and there are different seasons in people's lives, and there are some people who really are in a position that makes it very difficult for them to give and be generous. But I think everybody actually can give even a little bit. When the plate comes around, it's not just a fundraising function; it's an act of worship. It's one way of offering ourselves from our life and labor to the Lord. So the offering is about money, it's about bread and wine and music that we are offering to God for the Eucharist. And so it's an act of worship when we put something in the plate, when we say, here is a sign and symbol of some part of who I am from the rest of the week that I'm going to, as a sign of my dedication to God, of dedicating. In that same way, the Sabbath, Sunday, is not just the Lord's Day. The Lord's Day is not just Sunday. The whole week is the Lord's week, right? But the Sabbath is there to sanctify the rest of the week. In the same way, the tithe, or what we give of ourselves, is there to sanctify the rest of it. Anyhow, I got off track. So Bible study, personal testimony. The personal testimony is of the experience of God's grace through the practice of stewardship. Because it's about our relationship with God. It's about our trust in God. That kind of statement carries far more strongly, I think, than simply saying, oh, this church is really valuable in my life. I mean, I think those things are good as well. But really, for the practice of stewardship, that's much more holistic and much more than, well, church feels valuable to me now. Last year, it didn't feel as valuable, and so I gave less. If it's about stewardship, then that's a really important piece of it. The third piece is small group conversation. So you can make announcements to the whole crowd on a Sunday morning, but if you're sitting in groups as small as the group around this table and talking about stewardship, it could be over the course of a dinner, it could be in people's homes. There are a number of different ways that congregations have run stewardship programs to facilitate this. But if you have a small group of people maybe studying a passage of Scripture and maybe talking about their own experience of stewardship, some people might be new to it, some people might have different various experiences of it, but it gets them talking about their own personal experience of it. Those three elements we find are in common with almost all of the different stewardship programs that are successful that we see. These things really help people to engage in the process of stewardship. We have lay people get up. Well, we've done it differently each year, but we've had some lay people get up and talk about stewardship, and sometimes it's more personal, sometimes it's less personal, but when there really is that connection of their own experience of God in their lives, it really rings true. It's very, very memorable, wouldn't you say? Annual giving. Capital campaigns. How many of you have run capital campaigns in the recent past in your parish? Have been involved in them, where your parish has had a capital campaign in the last 5 years? So fewer than maybe I've seen. They come up in the life of the church. They're usually for large projects and so on. When you do, there are a number of good elements for them. If you really are inexperienced with doing a capital campaign, I would recommend getting a consultant. There are a number of different groups, small firms that do capital campaigns and help churches with capital campaigns. They understand the context of the church as different from being a secular nonprofit, and they can be very, very helpful. In these capital campaigns, it's not just simply asking for money, but it's involving the whole congregation in a lot of the questions about why we need to rebuild the roof, why we need to build this extension on, why we need to put air conditioning in the church, things like that. And it's a time where people can kind of step back and assess the life of the church and the ministry of the church and give some important feedback to the leadership as well. There are different ways to involve lay people in leadership in this. So you can have a cadre of lay leaders who then go and train other lay people to go out and talk with people one-on-one about the objectives of the capital campaign. I do recommend, and I've seen this in a number of cases, there are varieties of ways of doing this, but as a good rule of thumb, it could be a tithe from the capital campaign, where you tithe 10% of what you collect in for the capital campaign and give that to another organization that is in need. I think when St. David's raised money to build a new organ, if I'm not mistaken, we took the old organ that we had and we loaned it to a church. I don't know that we'll have any space for it if we ever want to collect back on it, you know. So we're doing some things in that process to be able to recognize the practice of tithing, of giving away something from ourselves as well. Planned giving is also another important piece. The prayer book, in fact, I think it's the prayer book, encourages clergy to teach about remembering the church in your will. So let's imagine that you're a small church and you have a budget of, say, $180,000, and you have one parishioner that gives $20,000 a year, and that person dies. That's a big adjustment in that budget. That's a big adjustment. But if that person is a person of means, probably so, giving $20,000 a year, then that person might be able to remember the parish in the will. And so can give $10 million or $500,000 or something like that. Let's say it's $200,000, right? Then at least you have 10 years to make that adjustment on those $20,000 if you're going to use it in that way. We'll talk a little bit later about ways in which those gifts can be restricted and the way you have to manage those funds. Does this sound familiar to you? Stewardship? Good, good, good. It's the foundation of what we do. We really need to keep that in mind. So let's start talking. Yes?
Yeah, I have a question about capital campaigns.
Yes.
If you are a church that each year does not manage to raise enough money and pledging to cover your budget, is it, and then at the same time you have an old infrastructure that has some serious needs, is it a bad idea to try to conduct a capital campaign because you can't seem to manage to get enough in annual pledging even?
No, I think it's... So if your annual pledges are always a little bit short of the budget you really need, can you really conduct...
A little bit short.
More than a little bit short. No. I know of a church that was considerably short and yet still ran a capital campaign. The capital campaign was for $125,000. So it wasn't very, it wasn't a whole lot. But, you know, the annual budget was $150,000. And these were important resources that were needed, an air conditioning system for the worship space, a wheelchair access ramp for the church, things like that. And it was fairly successful. The campaign was fairly successful. It can be a way of raising the awareness of the congregation of the financial needs of the church. It can be a way of revisiting the question of stewardship. It can be a way, you know, very often pledge campaigns, there's sort of one person who runs it, maybe there are two other people, and they get up on Sunday in October and they say you ought to make a pledge to the church, and people say, yeah, sure. It's kind of like, no, I said this last week, right? It's kind of like the adults in the Peanuts cartoons, wah, wah. You're not really paying attention. But when people are feeling the drip of the water on their head, then they're wondering about the leaky roof, then they can be a little bit more motivated to have the conversation. And when you draw in more and more people from the pews to lead the campaign, there's a lot of work that's done ahead of time in the quiet phase of a capital campaign normally, so that you know you have a really good base of support before you ask everybody in the church to give. You're building a depth of leadership. You're building a lot of time where people are talking about the financial needs of the church and the future of the church and the mission of the church. All those things are great. So even if you find yourself having an annual shortfall, a lot of times a capital campaign can help the annual budget, because people say, you know, this really is an important place to me, and I really am here for the long term. And so I need to think about what I do yearly as well as what I'm doing right now. It's tricky. You have to communicate clearly that this is not a substitute for the annual giving, but this is something in addition to it. Now, on top of that, though, there are a lot of funds available. The United Thank Offering is one. There are some other funds that are out there. There are ways in which churches can get grants to do some of the things that they need to do, whether they're significant maintenance or significant improvements or expansions as well. Do you do a capital campaign in the interim? My gut says probably not. The interim is always such a hard time in the life of any congregation. Even the healthiest of congregations, the anxiety level in the room just goes up. And when people are anxious, they tend not to be as generous. And there's a lot of uncertainty about the long-term direction of the church. One of the things that the consultants that we worked with at St. Mark's when we did our capital campaign, one of the things that the consultants were looking for on the feedback when they did this feasibility study and interviewed a lot of the people in the parish, they wanted to hear people spontaneously offering to them, well, we really like the church and we're really happy with the leadership and so on. Because if they don't hear that, then they're a little nervous about the success of the campaign itself. So if you have, you're probably better off to do the capital campaign when you have stable leadership in place. I mean, it may be important to go ahead and do it. Maybe you've laid a lot of the groundwork and all of a sudden you're without a rector, not because you planned it that way, but because you just have to. You can talk to some consultants about whether the time is right or not.
A lot of people that give money in the plate and give checks, you know, right.
Gosh, I think giving and pledging sometimes can be seen somewhat separately. And if envelopes help them to give, by all means, give them envelopes. Talking about pledging, I think, is important because it does help the vestry to plan. You can't hire a youth minister on the hopes that you're going to have the money to pay him or her. You know what I mean? So you have to, if you're making a commitment to pay somebody, then you have to know that there's enough commitment from the church behind you to back up that commitment. So pledging is important. There are a lot of people who are really skittish. I've found elderly folks, retired folks, very skittish about making promises that they feel like they can't follow through on. And part of my response is, we're the church. We're not going to be a collection agency, you know. But people still really feel bad about making a pledge and then not making it up. And there's a part of that instinct that's good. But I do think that I, you know, encourage people to take risks. To say, you know, how much should someone give? I think give as much as you're comfortable with and then give a little bit more. It ought to influence what you do with the part you don't give. It ought to influence how you think about your whole budget so that you're bringing God into those questions about, all right, well, God, how should I manage my mortgage and the tuition bill and all of this together? I'm going to go ahead and move on to the next section and hope that we have some time at the end to take some questions. But there's a lot of details in here, and I do want to make sure we cover the content. Okay. When you're sitting down to talk about the finances of the church, church finances are a little bit different from business finances. They're also different from secular nonprofit finances in some ways. It seems to me that a lot of secular nonprofits probably operate on maybe one, maybe two funds. In a church, you often have numerous funds with numerous different purposes, and it makes the accounting, it makes it a nightmare in terms of accounting. There's a lot to keep track of. Also, there are reporting requirements that the church has, both for the diocese and for the national church. So understanding church finances often starts with understanding the parochial report. How many of you have seen the parochial report from your congregation? Good, good, good. So you know what I'm talking about. Parochial reports. Three pages. The first page is signatures, so it's really two pages. One page has to do with vital statistics, sort of numbers of people in different categories. Second page has to do with finances. So what I want to do right now is go through this handout that has definitions for church finances. These are, if you haven't seen it already, you need to get one, the Manual of Business Methods in Church Affairs, which has all kinds of great resources and will tell you an awful lot, especially about accounting in the church. But it has stuff about audits and discretionary funds, and it's a very important resource to have. So you know what the parochial report is. You have to file it every, I think, by June 1st, if I'm not mistaken, for the previous year. And you file it with the diocese, and they send that information to the national church, and it's used to track statistics for parishes. And it also comes to play in things like standards for clergy compensation, and how much the church is assessed by the diocese. So how much money you are required to pay the diocese is based upon some of the figures from the parochial report. So first of all, active baptized member, who's this?
Us.
Anybody who's baptized and has had anything to do with the church over the last year, and their name is on the books. Let's say a young couple comes to join the church, and he's a Lutheran and she's a Roman Catholic, and they want to join the church. What do you do? Yeah, shake their hand, and the rector records them in the church register as baptized members. They don't have to be confirmed to be members of the church. Now, if they want to be confirmed communicants in good standing, they need to be confirmed or received by the bishop. And so there's that process that can go through. But the statistic of confirmed communicant in good standing is not used as much as active baptized member. So if you have two confirmed communicants in good standing and a child who is not baptized, the child is not counted in the active baptized membership, right? If you have somebody who is baptized and who gave a $50 check at Christmas and you haven't seen them since, are they an active baptized member of the church? Yes, if their name is on the rolls. Yeah, if they came to worship once, or if they contributed to the church, if their name is on the rolls of baptized members, that's for confirmed communicant in good standing. To be a communicant in good standing, you have to receive communion at least three times in the previous year. That's the difference. So active is barely active at all, really. It doesn't take much to be an active baptized member. Right. And if you're a large church like St. David's, who is this person? I know I baptized their kids about 5 years ago. Do they still come to church? I don't know. What do they look like? It becomes really hard to keep track. And so the roles of active baptized members balloon to huge size, and you don't know if it's really representative of the life of the church. Or you could have a lot of people on the rolls, but the church really is just falling apart, and so nobody shows up and gets involved. So really, the measure of vitality that is more commonly used is average Sunday attendance. Average Sunday attendance is just that, is the average of all of the attendance from Sunday services all throughout the year. This is for anybody who has attended all or part of the worship service. So let's say you have an atheist person walks in off the street and sits in the back pew and listens to the readings of Scripture and then walks out. Is that person to be counted? Yes, because that is a person who has attended part of the worship service. So you have a non-baptized baby in the back pew during communion. You count that baby. Yes, yes, you do. Now, let's say you have the daughter of the former rector, who is also the wife of the senior warden, who's in the kitchen all morning long. No, because she wasn't at worship. So if you have the nursery volunteer who was down in the nursery listening on the baby monitor to the worship service upstairs and somebody came and brought her communion? Yes. Good, because that's what I used to do. I'm glad I wasn't breaking the rules. I figure there's some tenuous thread that connects them to the worship service. But if you were just in the kitchen, no. You got to show up. You got to participate in some way. Average Sunday attendance. So if you were in the choir at 8 o'clock and you were in the choir at 10 o'clock, are you counted twice?
Yes,
you're counted twice. Same thing with clergy going to multiple services.
I have an usher at our parish I'd like you to talk to.
Yeah, you can. I mean, the Manual for Business Methods and Church Affairs gives you some definitions. Some of these, hypotheticals I've posed to people at 8:15 in New York just to make sure. Is this really how this works?
See, I have a question. Who's counting?
The usher.
Good question. Could be the ushers. Could be the priest. Could be vestry. But somebody ought to be counting. Now, is it highly crucial? Not necessarily, but standards for clergy compensation are based on average Sunday attendance. Average Sunday attendance is a good marker for vitality. If you have Christmas on a Sunday, what's that do to your average Sunday attendance? If you have Christmas on a Saturday, what does that do to your average Sunday attendance? Because nobody comes, not as much, fewer people come on that Sunday.
Weekend attendance, we have a Saturday night service.
Saturday night is technically a Sunday service, if it's late enough, yeah. Yeah, it's a vigil. It's, yeah, so it gets in on a technicality. Yeah, I suppose you could, but anyhow. No. It's not public liturgy of the church.
So weekday services don't count.
Weekday services don't count. They are counted as weekday services, and they are counted on the parochial report. But that's different from average Sunday attendance because the principal service on the Lord's Day is the primary place in which the community has its identity and carries out its mission. Starts with that worship, is centered in that worship service. So that's average Sunday attendance. And so these numbers do end up being important from time to time. So do try to keep track of them. Not try to keep track of them. Keep track of them, definitely keep track of them. Okay, on to finances. There is operating income and expenses, and non-operating income and expenses. So operating income and expenses are for the normal operations of the church. Non-operating income or expenses are those things that have to do with things outside the church. So let's say you took a special offering and you collected $1,000 and you sent it off to the church in Jerusalem. That's going to be non-operating income and non-operating expense. You follow me? Discretionary funds, I think, depending upon how they're funded, could be non-operating. Special projects or special outreach ministries of the church, depending upon how they're funded, can be non-operating. Why is this important? Well, it could be important for lots of reasons, but what's one?
That's what your assessment is.
Your assessments are based on operating income, not on non-operating. So it's kind of like thinking about your taxes and what's tax-exempt and what's not tax-exempt. Your assessments are based upon operating income or operating expense. Now, it gets a little tricky. Let's say you use savings on regular operating costs. That becomes operating income because it's used for an operating expense of the church. Let's say that you were... sometimes it can start to look like it's counted twice. So you can match it up with the expenses because the income and expenses can match. So let's say your budget was $150,000 and you collected $160,000. $10,000 you could count as non-operating income because it just went into savings. Or could you? It is tricky. It might end up getting counted twice. This is where the accounting really does get kind of tricky. But it is true. If you're taking it out of the bank and you're using it for operating expense, that is
non-operating.
Yeah, it's if you're taking money out of the bank and you're using it for operating expense, then it does get counted as operating income. I mean, and what that does is it catches a church that is living off of, how shall I put this, living off of dead people's money. You know, the church really should function, its operations should function off of the living stewardship of the living and active membership that are involved. So the assessments are going to take into account what's really going on in the church, and that may be a way of doing that, whether it comes from current pledges or whether it comes from savings. If this is your operations, then that should be reflected in it. I'm going to skip housing allowance and come back to it. I will come back to it, though. That's going to start us off on the strange world of clergy compensation. So flip the page. The diocesan pledge and diocesan assessments. What's the diocese? I'm going to stand on my soapbox for some opinions here. What's the diocese? We're the diocese, right? The diocese consists of all those Episcopalians who are in communion with our bishop in these five counties. So us, we're the diocese. So we don't send money to the diocese. This is where I get picky about words. We don't send money to the diocese. We send money to Church House for certain ministries that are not carried out by the parishes and institutions and missions of the church. You follow me? So most of the mission and ministry of the church is carried out in the parishes, but there are some ministries, perhaps more effectively and more helpfully, by the parishes working together. And that takes the form of the program budget of the diocese and the programs of the diocese, the diocesan ministry. And so when you send that assessment and that pledge to Church House, it funds the diocesan program budget. It funds other parts of the diocesan ministry. You follow me? Little vocabulary thing there. There are two parts of funding for diocesan ministries. One is a diocesan pledge, and it is voluntary. The other consists of three assessments that are mandatory, that the church is required to pay. And they are the episcopate assessment, the RCMA, Retired Clergy Medical Insurance, RCMI, thank you, yeah, that doesn't make sense. And the CF, yes, Clergy Financial Assistance. And the way they come up with these assessments, so if you look at the handout here, this year the assessments total about 3.49% of normal operating income. By the way, there's a difference between normal operating income and total operating income. Total operating income includes money that the diocese gives you. So let's say you're a parish that's receiving funding from the diocese. That funding is not included in normal operating income, but it's included in total operating income. Got to follow those details. So, where was I? So, as a percentage of normal operating income, these assessments are paid. And the way they come up with this is that there are different bodies that are responsible for these different funds, but whoever's responsible will say, okay, the episcopate needs $300,000 this year. And they take that $300,000 and they'll divide that by the total normal operating income for all the parishes in the diocese. And you get a percentage. And that percentage is 1.81%. And then they apply that to each individual parish. Do you see how that works? So they start off with a raw number, and they come up with a percentage based upon how it compares to the income of the parishes. And they do the same thing for Retired Clergy Medical Insurance and Clergy Financial Assistance. So Clergy Financial Assistance is for clergy in need, with some financial need. The fund for the episcopate is for the bishop and for the staff that works directly for the bishop. So the canon for deployment would not fall under this. The youth ministry for the diocesan youth ministry would not fall under the episcopate. You follow me? Those are part of the program budget. Program budget. How many of you have been to a convention? So you should know what this is. Because convention sets the program budget. And this is the budget for diocesan ministries that is funded by a pledge from the parish, pledge from each parish. And the pledge is voluntary. Now the diocese asks for 10% of normal operating income for the pledge. But if you've been part of diocesan politics in the last several years, you know that a lot of congregations don't give that 10%. And some have chosen to use this as kind of a battleground and say, well, we don't like this, what's going on, so we're not making a pledge, and so on. It's a conflict.
Comment, at the last special meeting, to be eligible to vote for the incoming provisional bishop, there was a bylaw requiring parishes to be paid in full, so they lay clergy representatives.
Every diocesan convention, whether it's a special convention or a regular convention, in order to be seated with a voice and vote, you have to be up to date in your assessments.
Unless it's waived.
Is it 1 year or is it 2 years in a row? That sort of thing. They're very often waived.
It's the assessment, not the program.
Correct. It's the assessment. It's the assessment.
We've had a lot of confusion in our church.
Right. So the total that the diocesan ministry would like to receive from each parish would be, in this case, about 13.5%. 10% for the pledge, 3.5% for the assessments. Mm-hmm. You follow how that works? With me so far? Okay. We're going to talk a little bit about some other definitions that are important for the parish accounting. Unrestricted funds, permanently restricted funds, temporarily restricted funds. I don't know if this is ringing any bells for any of you. Unrestricted funds are those funds that the vestry can use for anything they so choose for the mission of the church, correct? Restricted funds are restricted by the donor. You follow me? If the vestry says, well, we have this money, we're going to set it aside for this purpose, that's not a restricted fund. In the language of accountants, it is not restricted funds. So you could call it designated funds, but you see, the vestry then has the authority to undesignate it and redesignate it for something else because it was the vestry who made that decision in the first place. In the accounting language, a restricted fund is restricted by the donor. And when the gift was accepted by the vestry, the restriction was accepted along with it. So if somebody says, I'm going to give $1 million, and I want you to use this $1 million to build a zoo in the backyard and fill it with zebras, the vestry is charged with the responsibility of deciding whether or not they want to accept that gift and its restriction. But if they accept the gift, they accept the restriction and they have to use it just for the zebras, right? You don't have to accept it, okay? Usually you can go back and say, that's really generous of you. I wonder if you might consider using it, allowing us to use it for something else. The roof is leaking in the church and we're working on a capital campaign for that. Wouldn't that be nice? Most people, if they care about the church, would be willing to have their purpose put into a different direction, you know, if the case is well made for that. But if you accept it, you accept the restriction. Two kinds of restricted funds: temporarily restricted funds, permanently restricted funds. Temporarily restricted fund is where I give $1,000 to buy hymnals. Okay, so it's restricted for that purpose. But it's temporary because you use that money to buy the hymnals. Then it's gone. Permanently restricted fund is where the money, where the capital stays and earns income, dividend income or interest income that the church can use. So that's normally what's meant by permanently restricted funds. So technically you can't spend it. You can just spend the income from it. Now, of course, if a church is absolutely failing and needs to dip into the principal, then you probably won't get a lot of arguments about that. But if a vestry is irresponsible and starts spending the principal, then the donor or the heirs, the donor's heirs, people could challenge that use, as well they should, because you want to do a good job of keeping good faith with the people who give you money so that the people that you ask for money next will have reason to have faith in that you're going to use it well.
There are circumstances where you can dump all the temporarily restricted funds into the general fund to keep the, if it's necessary for the, to keep the church open. Are there any official rules about that or guidelines from the national church or from the diocese?
Well, it's a specific question, and if you've got auditors or accountants you can talk to about that, or it may be more a question of law. I think when a donor puts a restriction on there, the donor can require you to use it the way it's been restricted for. So if you want to do it differently, technically what you ought to do is you ought to get permission for the donor to change the purpose.
Well, I mean when it's been left in the will, this is just what I've heard, is that there are certain circumstances under which a church, and we are not in that circumstance, but I've just heard that there are circumstances where you are allowed to combine any restricted funds into
I think a case probably can be made for it. You know, legally, if we're talking about a lot of money, the stakes get higher, the more money we're talking about, because then people can challenge it in court, and so you really ought to go to Orphan's Court to get permission to do that. And the court might say, well, obviously you need this, and this is a good use of it, and we understand, and it's not a problem. If it's a small amount of money, then it's probably not a problem, but it's also probably good courtesy to be in touch with, say, the family of the person who left the money in the will, and then you can get permission, and everything's fine. It's just trust. You want to maintain trust with the people who make restricted gifts.
I think that was part of the problem that we have had in this diocese in the last
yes.
few years.
Yes. Can we trust that when we give money for a particular purpose, that it's not going to be used for a different purpose? That's been a lot of the conflict in the diocese for a while. Questions, at least, have arisen about that. You follow that? Restrictions on funds. Because of that, you have to keep track when you do financial reporting. Then in the church, you have to keep track of okay, this is the finances for the restricted funds or the permanently restricted funds. Here's for the temporarily restricted funds. Here are the unrestricted funds, and it gets hairy. And then you have these other funds because somebody said, well, this fund is only for this purpose. This fund is for that purpose. You know, we have 10 different memorial funds to memorialize 10 different people, and they have $500 each. You know how. It really gets hairy. If you can encourage folks to give unrestricted funds or to give to a fund that already exists that's got a restriction on it, it just makes it so much cleaner in terms of the accounting. And the cleaner it is, the more transparent the accounting is, and the more people will trust the system. When they can look at your books and understand them, the better off you are. If they look at the books and you've got page after page after page and it gets confusing, that makes it. That makes it harder, I think, as you seek to manage those funds. Do you understand the difference between pledge and plate? Anybody not understand the difference between pledge and plate? Raise your hand, it's okay. You guys are way ahead of me. Discretionary funds. Discretionary funds are money that is either given specifically for the discretionary fund or the vestry can set aside. Very often it's the loose offering from the first Sunday of the month will go into the rector's discretionary fund. A discretionary fund, then the rector can use that discretionary fund as he or she sees fit for particular purposes. So here's a little quiz. Can the rector use the rector's discretionary fund to pay for his son's college tuition that's so expensive?
No.
Having a son in college right now, I, you know, might be disappointed with that, but no. Very good. Good answer. So you guys are in the advanced class, so let me think of a tougher question. Would it be appropriate for the rector to use the discretionary fund for to pay for child care for his kids?
No.
Would it be appropriate for the rector to pay for child care coordinators to come in to work the nursery on Sunday morning?
Yes.
No. Because that's an operation of the church's ministry. Why should the discretionary fund be used for the operations of the church?
Right?
It's an ongoing expense. It's something that the stewardship of the parish should be able to provide. What if the parish doesn't have the money? Well, this is a question of stewardship, right? Because If it takes money to run the Sunday school, or let's say it's the nursery, if it takes money to run the nursery, then that money ought to come from the church. And if the church doesn't have that money, should they really be doing something to operate? God hasn't given you the resources to have a nursery, then you don't have a nursery. But of course, most of the time, God actually has given you the resources to run the nursery. It's just a question of... but it's not. It's not. And here's, I'm going to make a point of it. This is the thing. The discretionary fund is for people who are in need, individuals who are in need. It is not for the operation of the church. It can be so tempting. Here's this nugget out there. and we feel so needy. Why doesn't the rector just pay for this church program from the discretionary fund? Because that's not what the discretionary fund is for. The discretionary fund is for when somebody comes to the rector and says, my marriage is absolutely falling apart, and the rector says, you know, counseling would really be helpful, and the person says, there's no way we can afford counseling. We don't have insurance anyway, and they charge $150 an hour. And the rector can say, I'll pay for the first five sessions. And nobody has to know about it. Somebody says, I'm an alcoholic. Somebody comes up and says, I'm addicted to cocaine. And I'm a basket case, but nobody knows about it, and I'll lose my job if people find out. The rector can pay for rehab out of that discretionary fund if it's large enough. To pay for rent when somebody's going to be evicted. To pay for food when somebody's hungry. That's what the discretionary fund is for. So, it would be sad not to be able to pay somebody to work in the nursery, but it would be even more sad for the person to be evicted from their apartment because the church wasn't able to be there at that moment. So that's what the discretionary fund is for. It is really tempting to use it for ministries in the church, but it's kind of a big deal. I mean, clergy can kind of lose their collar over misuse of the discretionary fund. So there is some information in the Manual for Business Methods and Church Affairs that talks about the use of the discretionary fund, and it's important to keep track of.
Are you saying as long as there's a confidential accounting, the fund itself doesn't have to be segregated?
The fund itself, it is helpful for the discretionary fund itself as an account of money to be segregated. So it's helpful to have a separate checking account that is for the discretionary fund. It is very important to have more than one signature on that account so that several things. If the rector gets hit by a bus, somebody else can sign the checks. It's the hit by a bus rule, right? Always have to have the hit by a bus rule. It is not the rector's account. It is the discretionary fund of the rector of the parish. It's the parish's account, but the rector is the chief person who's using it and signing it. You follow that? Because if it belongs to the rector's got to pay taxes on that because that's income. In the eyes of the IRS. So you have to protect the rector against that.
Does the rector have to get vestry permission to make expenditure?
No. No. That's why it's the discretionary fund. But when I say you need other signers, I don't mean that you need three signers to sign any check. What it means is that you have three people who can sign the check. So if the rector gets hit by a bus, somebody else can sign it. If the rector's on vacation and somebody comes in and is in need, then whoever is handling pastoral issues at that time can sign checks from the discretionary fund and use it. That's what's important. Now, here's the tricky thing. How do you know that the rector's not paying for his son's tuition? You have to have the account audited. So what's discreet about it if it's audited by the vestry? Tricky, right? I really can't quite envision the cleanest way to do this, but there are a couple of different strategies. One might be to sit down and with a bank statement, because the bank statement doesn't say to whom it was written and why, but to basically say, yeah, that was for somebody's rent. Yes, this was for somebody's counseling. Yes, this was for food for someone, and so on, and explain each of those expenditures. You may have somebody from outside the parish come in to audit the discretionary fund so that there's not a personal connection. Especially the smaller a parish is, the more that confidentiality can be risky if you have somebody else from the parish that's involved in looking it through. Naturally, you'd want to be careful of having the rector get his best buddy from the church down the road come but clergy are generally pretty good people, and they understand the limits on discretionary fund. That may be one way of doing it, but you would hate to have it. You do want to make it look transparent while trying to preserve some of that confidentiality if you can. The audit committee is responsible for seeing that the discretionary fund is audited, whether it is by them or not. If you have outside auditors, that's easy. Then the rector ought to be able to be completely transparent with them about what the fund has been used. Does that make sense? Does that help you out on that?
Are you going to tell us what the vestry's responsibility is for auditing church finances?
I can do that. I hadn't planned on it, but I will, yes. I've heard a couple of different approaches to this, but basically an audit needs to be filed every year. And there are forms for doing quick audits. If you're a small church, a self-audit is something that you can do. There are forms, here again, in the Manual for Business Methods and Church Affairs. An audit is not just do the numbers add up. An audit is what's the policy for cash management? Who counts the cash? Who puts it in the bank? Are there two signers for anything over X amount of dollars? Are they following procedures? Where is the mortgage statement for the loan that you have? Where's the title held? How are the securities managed? So it's a lot of it is a policy check. And I would really recommend that every church of any size have an outside firm come in and do an audit periodically, at least periodically. If you're a large church, you should pay somebody to come in and do an audit every year. But even a small church that has a self-audit committee, people who are made up, some vestry members, some outside of the vestry, that can do this audit. Because if they're all within the vestry, that's kind of, that's not transparent enough. You need to have somebody accountable from outside the decision-making process. So the treasurer can't really sit on the audit committee. The treasurer is going to sit down with the audit committee and answer a lot of questions. But the treasurer can't really be the auditor of the books, right? It's about accountability. But I would say at least every 5 years, a small church ought to have an outside auditor come in. And you learn great things, especially if you have a good auditing firm. And there are a few that do a lot of work for churches and understand how churches work. But you discover things. I'll give you a management letter, and they say, you know, your cash management policy is not sufficient. Doesn't mean that somebody's going to get thrown in jail. It just means here's the things you really have to improve next year. And then the next year when you do an audit, they'll look at that management letter and say, cash management. And you might say nothing, and that's really embarrassing. Or you might say, well, we brought it up in a vestry meeting, and we decided that we were going to have vestry members count the money every Sunday or something like that. You had a question?
Is there a list of good audit firms, like through the diocese, who actually know church finances?
The answer is probably yes. I think if you talk to Rob Rogers, who is the controller of the diocese, I think he probably will know some good resources. Brian, do you remember the name of the auditor that helps us?
BBD.
BBD? Okay. BBD. They've done the diocesan books. I know they've done St. David's.
I don't know whether or not they went through with it, but a couple of conventions ago, the treasurer, I don't think it was Rob at that time, but the treasurer had put some CPA people together who would go through the diocese, you know, and do audits for those churches who could not financially, you know. But I don't know if it went into effect.
It's probably still on an ad hoc basis, but I think it's that if you call Rob Rogers, he knows some people who know some people that could help you out. And the annual vestry symposium, kind of annual, usually has a presentation that talks a little bit about audits as well.
We were really small. No way could we afford an outside audit. So we did the self-audit a couple of years, and that was very useful. And of course, we submitted the audit report and it was accepted. But then we talked about, once we had done it a couple of times, got a little expertise, we never got to this, but we talked about swapping self-audits with neighboring churches.
That's a great idea. That's a great idea.
So we would audit them, they would audit us.
There's some work on the diocesan level that's being done on congregational development. And those committees might really welcome knowing that there are some self-audit committees out there that are willing to do that. It does cost a little bit of money, but I do think it's helpful periodically to have somebody come in from the outside and notice the things that you have overlooked year after year just because you're part of the system. So I'd recommend it. I mean, it does take some discipline of setting some money aside to do it. But the self-audit is also certainly possible to do. They're checklists. You just go off checklists. Okay, I'm looking at the time. On to the strange world of clergy compensation, and I'm going to start with the housing allowance. Now, I'm going to show you numbers, and we're going to do some math, so don't be scared. Before we do that, I'm going to tell a story. It probably isn't historically true, but it's close enough, and I think it helps you to understand the story. So this is how I, in my imagination, imagine that the strange about housing allowance and the really screwy world of clergy compensation came to be what it is. Back hundreds of years ago, each parish church also had a building for the parish priest to live in, called
the rectory,
yes. And if you're Lutheran, it was called the manse. And if you were Presbyterian, it was called The parsonage, yes, or something like that, right. So, and it was, the steeple, the basement. And this was convenient because then the actual cash that you needed to pay the priest every year didn't have to be as much because the priest didn't have to go out and spend money on housing, right? So this goes on for hundreds of years, and the religious world is all happy with this until you develop something in the United States called the income tax. And they want to tax income. And then the General Motors CEO decides, I know how to avoid income tax. Instead of having them pay me cash, I'll just have them buy a house for me that I live in that's got 20 rooms and so on. And then the IRS with the green eyeshade guys say, wait a minute now. That ought to count as income. Now, they didn't give you money, but they gave you something that was worth something. It had value, right? How do we assess that value? I know. We'll determine what's the fair rental value for that house. In fact, the fair rental value furnished for that house. And we're going to make you pay tax on that value. Because, really, that's income. It may not be cash, but it's income. Somebody spent some money on doing this for you. So we're going to call that income, right? Go back to the poor parish priest shivering in his cold rectory. And the church says, wait a minute, how can we afford for the priest to be able to afford to pay the tax and so on? Outrageous, how dare you do this to the church? So there's an exception in the IRS rules that says a minister of the gospel, the housing for the minister of the gospel is exempt from federal taxes. Right? You with me so far? So the same thing doesn't apply. The priest who lives in the rectory doesn't have to figure for federal taxes the fair rental value and pay income tax on that figuring. Right? So, there's another priest. You've got Father Joe living in the rectory, and you've got Mother Sally who is working for a parish who doesn't have a rectory. So she's got to get paid income and then use that income on the mortgage or on the rent, and says, wait a minute, that's a raw deal. How come he doesn't have to get pay taxes on what is some of his income, but I have to pay tax on all my income? So, the portion of Mother Sally's income that she uses to pay for housing is considered tax exempt. You with me? Right? Doesn't change how much St. Swithin's pays Mother Sally. Right? But a portion of that the vestry designates as housing, is exempt from taxes. With me so far? Mm-hmm. Oh, and by the way, when the Social Security system comes up, they say it's all taxable. We're going to tax all of it. So even Father Joe over here in the rectory is going to have to pay Social Security tax on the value of that provided housing. So now Father Joe does need to figure fair rental value furnished for the rectory. You with me so far? One hopes. Okay, here's the big reveal. All right, so let's just say that this is Mother Sally. She gets paid a cash salary of $70,000. So how much does the church spend? How much does St. Swithin's spend to pay Mother Sally?
$70,000.
Okay, they designate $40,000 out of that $70,000 as housing allowance and $30,000 as salary. How much do they spend?
$70,000.
What if it was 20-50? How much do they spend?
$70,000.
How much if it was 68-2?
$70,000.
Right. So what the vestry designates as housing allowance makes no difference to the bottom line of the parish. You follow me? Yes. We're getting there. Yes. Okay. So this is the housing allowance. And the vestry, every year in December, that is to say before January, designates a certain portion of the priest's income as housing allowance for the upcoming year. And the vestry provides that priest with a letter saying so. Important if the priest ever gets audited, right? So Mother Sally's housing allowance is $40,000. Now, she happens to live in a house whose fair rental value furnished is $38,000. So in other words, Mother Sally calls up the real estate agent that's helped to sell her the house, and she says, what would you get for rent for my house? And she comes up with a number, and that's if the house was empty. Okay, let's say it was furnished. Well, furnished would probably be another $1,000 a month. And then they add all that up and say annually, a person renting this house, if it were furnished, a person would spend $38,000. You with me so far? What's tax exempt? 40 or 38? 38, because 38 is less than 40. It turns out that Mother Sally actually spent on mortgage and insurance and gas for the lawnmower and the new furnace and some paint for the family room, $36,583. How much is tax exempt? $36,583. You follow me? Now, what if the vestry had said, your housing allowance is $30,000? How much would be tax exempt?
$30,000.
It's the lowest. So if you follow me, it's helpful for the priest to have the housing allowance a little on the high side, because if the furnace dies, then the $5,000 the priest has to spend replacing the furnace can fit into that $40,000, if you follow me. 34,17. Okay? Oh, no. Yeah, 34,17. Now, it is the responsibility of the priest, however, Mother Sally in this case, if this is the actual costs, then Mother Sally needs to add $3,417 in as excess housing allowance as income on line 21 of her 1040. You follow me? Because the W-2 said the salary was only $30,000, but her actual expenses were lower than that $40,000 for housing allowance. The W-2 also should say that there was $40,000 in housing allowance on there. So the excess housing allowance should be counted in as income. Now, the IRS would not really want this to be too much of a habit. So, you know, all $70,000 is housing allowance, but the actual was really only like $30,000. Well, it just gives a lot of leeway for the priest to forget to have that excess housing allowance declared as income, if you follow me. So, yeah, the housing allowance ought to be reasonable, a reasonable number. And I think if you really want to get picky, the IRS would expect the vestry to inquire just to make sure that the number is reasonable. But you can have some circumstances where the housing costs are so high, and maybe it's a married couple, and the priest is married, and so all of the priest's salary is designated as housing because the costs are that high and the rent is that high where they live. Say it's in the middle of Philadelphia or in the middle of New York City where the rents are really high. Could be really that expensive. So some clergy do take the vast bulk of their salary as housing. So you with me so far? What's actually exempt is the lowest of the actual cost, the fair rental value furnished, or the housing allowance set by the vestry. Let's say the vestry forgets to set the housing allowance. In an audit, goose egg, zero is exempt. So do your priests a favor. Help them out here. You with me so far? Now, because of this strange thing about housing allowance, clergy compensation is really strange, and clergy taxes are really strange. So here's some numbers. These are also on the bottom of this handout that I gave you. So let's say these numbers reflect the current standards, diocesan standards. Every year there is a resolution at the diocesan convention that gets voted on about clergy compensation, and they set various numbers for various different size congregations. So this is where the average Sunday attendance and the normal operating income also factors into standards for clergy compensation. So these numbers reflect the midpoint for the rector of a family-sized church, and in a case where the rector is living in a rectory. And so that number for the cash compensation is $52,930. And of that, that's salary and housing. Now, this rector is living in a rectory, so the housing allowance is not going to be huge, but still the rector mows the lawn, makes some small repairs, does some things around the house. Pardon me?
Shovels the driveway.
You know, so there's some costs. So maybe the rector's housing allowance is going to be $2,000 to cover those expenses. And this person is going to go through the same thing that we just talked about for Mother Sally, right? Even though Father Joe's living in the rectory. Well, there has to do with, you know, is this tax exempt and what were the actual costs that you have to keep track of. But notice it doesn't really, the number is still going to be that 52,930. Father Joe is going to pay tax on 50,930. You follow me? That's the number that's taxable by federal income taxes. So considered employees for the purposes of federal income taxes. But because, I assume, the housing thing, housing is taxed for Social Security and Medicare, they are considered self-employed for Social Security and Medicare. So when you sit down to do your taxes, it's kind of complicated. But the point is that, remember, is that you can't take FICA, you can't take Social Security out of the priest's check. So normally what's done is you take a whole lot more in federal taxes and federal withholding for federal taxes out of the paycheck than might normally be expected for that paycheck. And then when the priest does his or her taxes at the end of the year, all that withholding goes to pay for the Medicare self-employment tax. They file Schedule SE, right? When you file Schedule SE, you have to include the housing allowance. You have to include the utility costs that the church paid for the rectory. So let's say the church paid $700 for heating oil and for electricity and for trash, sewer, and water. That gets counted for Social Security tax, for the self-employment tax. And the priest pays all 15.3%, right? So there's a balance. You say, well, the priest gets such a great tax advantage. Yeah, well, the priest is also paying a whole lot in Social Security. It comes back around if the priest lives long enough. And if the Social Security system is still intact when the priest retires. But nonetheless, in the meantime, there is some additional pressure there. The priest also pays Social Security tax on the fair rental value of that rectory. You follow me? Now, the church pension fund, for its purposes, will calculate housing as salary. Because I've worked it out, is close to $17,000 in this case. Church pension fund will require the parish to pay a payment that annually is equal to 18% of all of this. So that 18% is not just of the cash, but it's also of the utilities and the value of the rectory. It's $13,254. It's a lot of money for pension for clergy. It's a good, I mean, from my standpoint, from my side of the collar, it's a good system for clergy for their retirement. For the Diocese of Pennsylvania, $29,060. So, let's go through what costs actually come out of the budget for the parish. $52,930? Yes. Right? $3,700? Where's it go to? Utility companies. Right? So you're not paying the priest, but you're paying the utility companies. This is for the rectory, right? $17,000? No, this is just the imputed value, the fair rental value of living in the rectory. So there's no cash that changes hands, but it gets taxed for Social Security purposes, and it's assessed for pension benefits. Right? How about the pension? Goes to church pension fund, right? And health insurance? Yes. Yes, goes to the health insurance people. So the costs for the parish in this scenario add up to be about how much? About $100,000. That's a lot of money. That's a lot of money for a small church. And that's family-sized church for a rectory. That's the midpoint of the range. They give you a midpoint, and they say it can be a little bit, it can be below or above within a given range. Thank you all very much for coming.
Thank you.
I'll stick around. Go in peace to love and serve the Lord.